Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with J.J. Cooper, I'm John Manuel, battling a head cold, so I hope you... I apologize for my volume, which I'll be compensating for too much in your headphones. But thank you all for joining us. It's a busy news day at Baseball America, busy news week. The winter meetings are coming up, J.J. We have a ton of news going on just today here in the office. Today's Thursday, December 3rd, that we're recording this on. And we have so much to talk about, we just should dive right in. You can email us. We do have a podcast question that we'll take at podcast@baseballamerica.com. Obviously, you can follow us all during the winter meetings next week at Twitter, twitter.com/baseballamerica, or just join the 6,000 or so people already following Baseball America on Twitter. And, J.J., we'll have so much to discuss next week. I think there will be a lot going on with Rule 5. Maybe I just should tweet the entire Rule 5 draft. That would be fun, actually. We can talk Rule 5 draft preview. We can talk National League West top 10 prospects. In 2 weeks, the prospect handbook goes to press, so we're all busy about the prospect handbook.
Got a lot I think you have now 70.
I have 72 prospects left to write. I'm 8 away from finishing the Phillies. I'm really late the Phillies.
I've got 30 left to go.
But I have done all my interviews but one, basically.
You're ahead of me on
that. Wrap up my interviews during the winter meetings with just like, okay, so I slide this guy up or down. But I've done all my interviews except for one as far as gathering the information for these organizations, talking to guys in and out of the organizations for the Yankees, Phillies, and Twins. I'm very fortunate to do 3 organizations that I've done before. I think people in those organizations have a level of trust with me, and they and are fairly forthcoming. And also, I know pro scouts who do those organizations, so that's been comfortable, and that's why I've left a little bit of this to the last minute, because I do feel comfortable I can bring all that together. So that's fun to do. Where should we start?
National League West. So we've got some of them up. We have, I think the Padres going up basically went up a little bit before we recorded this.
Right.
Matt Eddy's chatting Thursday afternoon. We still have the Dodgers and Diamondbacks, which are coming next week. But we can talk about them a little bit here. The question we've been asking for each of these podcasts when we talk about top 10. So which system is the best? Which is the best top 10 in the division? And who do you think is the number one prospect in the division?
I think I like the Giants farm system the best in this division. And I'm going off the board, well, not that far off the board, but I'm bucking our own top tens. My favorite prospect in this division is Madison Bumgarner, and obviously I'm more on the Bumgarner train than most people are. I don't think his diminished velocity this year is that big of an issue. I think the bigger issue is the secondary stuff, but I've talked about it, and if you command the fastball, you create angle on the fastball, and you pitch off the fastball, the secondary stuff does not have to be that special. I believe in Madison Bumgarner. I believe in the makeup, the mound presence, the fastball, the athleticism. I take him over Buster Posey. I hear, and I think I pass this on to Andy Baggerly, but it was after that horse had already left the barn. But I just talked to a scout the other day and doing Rule 5 stuff and cross-checking my 3 organizations. We just got on a Buster Posey tangent, and he was the second scout I've talked to this year who really had significant questions about Buster Posey's receiving ability. And you better be a good receiver when your pitchers are Matt Cain and Tim Lincecum and Jonathan Sanchez and Brian Wilson.
Even throw a Merkin Valdez in there.
Yeah, they have some serious stuff in San Diego, but obviously it starts with Lincecum. So if you can't handle Tim Lincecum, your position value at catcher is pretty nullified. He might be a worse receiver than Jorge Posada, and this scout gave Jorge Posada a 40 grade as a receiver, and it used to be a 30. And we've all seen Jorge Posada in the postseason just clank balls off his glove. And if you can't get borderline pitches for a guy like Jonathan Sanchez, who doesn't have good command and only has really average control, he needs your help. And if you can't help him as your Buster Posey, that's why you didn't play in September and they played Benji Molina. I have reservations about Buster Posey. I also have reservations on his ultimate offensive ceiling. I'll go back to Matt Blood's scouting report in 2008 when Matt saw, when he was working for us before he was scouting for the Cardinals, when he saw Gordon Beckham and Buster Posey on the same weekend. And this scout talked about Buster Posey in the same light that he talked about with Dominic Brown. If you question Dominic Brown's power potential, it's because you question the explosion in his hands, his rings, wrists, and forearms. And he questions the strength and the explosion and just the quote-unquote lack of thunder in Buster Posey's hands. He's more as a 10 to 14 home run guy, kind of like a Russell Martin without that level of defensive value. So I like Buster Posey. I like Madison Bumgarner better.
I'll agree with you. I think the Giants have the number one system in the division. I will say I think the Rockies are not that far behind.
I agree.
Especially when you look at the amount of pitching that's in that organization.
Absolutely agree.
I mean, the pitching, you know, you've got Tyler Madsen, Christian Friedrich at the top.
Those are two. Christian Friedrich would be a solid number one. People forget. We had him, I think, in our top 10 in the 2008 draft prospects. We thought he was going to go in that 8 to 15 range in the draft. He wound up falling into Colorado's laps at 26, and I really don't know why. All he did was dominate Wood Bat competition for 2 years. Maybe the fact that he was at Eastern Kentucky scared some people off. Maybe the fact that he pitched more off the breaking balls in college. But who doesn't in college? So I'm a Friedrich fan. I still thought Matzik needed to be number one.
Right. No, I think Matzik's number one. There's no doubt about that. But that system, the pitching in that system stood out. Like, Ethan Rogers, number nine.
Yeah.
Ethan Rogers, there's a lot of organizations I can think of where Ethan Rogers would be making an argument to be number three, number four.
I agree. I had a glowing scouting report out of him in the Texas League this year, and he was in the running when we did our midseason top 25. I don't remember if he was in the top 25 or if he might have just been in the 26 to 50. But Julius Chassin still eligible, and they got Rex Brothers in this year's draft. We liked their draft in 2009, rated as the top-ranked draft. I agree with you. They're not far behind the Giants. I still have my questions about the Giants developing position players.
It has gotten better.
It's gotten better. Thomas Neal, here's a little tidbit. Thomas Neal was a draft and follow out of their 05 draft, J.J. The Giants spent less than $600,000 in the first 10 rounds of that draft, didn't pick till the fourth round of the best draft of the decade because of the free agents
they decided
that year,
they
punted on that draft. They still got three big leaguers out of that draft. Alex Hinshaw has been in the big leagues. Sergio Romo has thrown 60 innings in the big leagues. Joe Martinez, who pitched for them in the big leagues this year, made six starts. And Thomas Neal's part of that draft. So they could get four big leaguers out of that draft, and I think they could get a regular in Thomas Neal and a regular reliever in Sergio Romo. So that just tells you how good that draft was. That 2005 draft was the best draft of that class, and all those are post-10th round guys.
And I was gonna
the Giants
say, but that's
credit
not
to
how good the draft was, because when you get past the 10th round, what you're talking about, that's how good the scouting was.
That's true, too. That's true, too. I think there was more
no
depth
draft,
of talent.
There's
right?
depth of that? Talent, right. But when you get past the 10th round,
yeah,
no draft is 10, you know, beyond 10 rounds deep of,
right.
of talent
right.
where you say, oh, in the 12th round, you should be able to get a big leaguer.
I think that's right. They got all those guys after the 10th round. And then since then, the reason the Giants have the best farm system in the division is first round 2006, Tim Lincecum, first round 2007, Madison Bumgarner, and later Tim Alderson, who they used in a trade this year, first round 2008, Buster Posey. They've made good picks. And I also agree with Jim Callis, if you're the Rays and you drafted Buster Posey first overall in 2008 instead of Tim Beckham, I think they took the wrong Beckham. But second of all, if you take Buster Posey, you don't have to trade for Kelly Schaap because they just did this week. He gives you other options. He's a hometown guy. Maybe some Florida State fans would have come out. Maybe you get Jen Sturger to come to some of your games at the Trop. That might increase attendance at least a little bit just to get some Florida State cowgirls in there. Maybe Bobby Bowden drops by, forgets where he is. He's 80 years old. It could happen. Mickey Andrews is done. He's got plenty of time on his hands. I digress. It's the Baseball America podcast. He's JJ. I'm John. But I like the Rocky system. Most of this decade, JJ, the Dodgers have been the top farm system in this division.
Or at least how we've ranked it. Although when we look back in hindsight, we did say, if you look back in hindsight, that's probably, if we could re-rank it now, you probably don't say the Dodgers had the number one system of this decade.
You probably say the Diamondbacks.
The Diamondbacks. When we're doing
probably go Diamondbacks, Rockies, Dodgers, actually.
You know, because the Diamondbacks, the depth that they have, the amount of talent that they have produced is extremely impressive.
It's pretty staggering. It was mostly in the earlier part of the decade, and their last couple of drafts have been quite conservative, and I would say they have the worst present farm system in the division, and I say it's by a long shot. Six guys from this year's draft go straight into their top ten.
If you're decoding at home, it doesn't matter how many picks you have. If you pick up a top 10, you're looking at the top 10, and that many guys from that year's draft are in the top 10, that's basically a little flashing light saying, you know, there's not a whole lot that appears to be in this system.
That's correct. It's surprising that they've – I like Tom Allison. I don't know him well, but he's very polite to talk to, their scouting director who's in charge there. But since he took over, it really has been a very conservative, college-oriented approach. This year they took some high school guys. I think I'm highest on Chris Owings, personally, out of all the guys they drafted, even over Borchering. Chris Owings got some Gordon Beckham comps. And I think that's the reason. I think 4 years ago, Chris Owings would not have been drafted nearly as high. But people compare him to Gordon Beckham, and Gordon Beckham, the way scouts in the Southeast think, he slipped through the cracks and wound up in college, and they didn't want the same thing to happen to Chris Owings, which was to the detriment of South Carolina, which thought they had a, you know, another guy to come into their tradition of shortstops there. But the Diamondbacks, what they produced in the last decade, JJ, is kind of amazing. I mean, we left out, and I would be curious to get feedback at podcast@baseballamerica.com to get the print edition of the magazine.
And also going up,
those online?
Going up tomorrow.
Okay.
We're going to put up the entire NL tomorrow.
Fever charts of how each team's organization has ranked, and a top 10 prospects of the decade for each organization. You had to have appeared in a top 10, not a top 30, but a top 10 in the magazine to be considered for this top 10 of the decade. And the Diamondbacks had like 20 significant guys to consider, really. I mean,
where are those other teams in the NL that when we were doing, it's like you get down to number 4 and you're going, okay.
The Giants are one of them. Pedro Feliz, I think, is number 4, and he's had a solid big league career, but he's really never sniffed being an all-star. His defense makes him a first-division regular, but generally he's been a second-division regular. He's a first-division regular because the rest of the Phillies team is so ridiculous that they can carry.
By the way, I love that term's still thrown around, which is a term that has not been really true. There's now been like 3 generations of scouts who have scouted and then basically passed on.
Yeah, you're right.
Since there was really the difference between the first division and the second division
right.
of the National League.
There were 8 teams in the National League the last in 1961.
Right.
That is an anachronistic term if there ever was one.
I think that the Browns this year are going to be a second division club.
That's right. That's back when the Kansas City A's were a team. So the only organization that we really haven't touched on is the one that's going up today, JJ, San Diego. And news involving San Diego today, 2 pieces of news. First, they hire Jason McLeod, the Red Sox scouting director, as their assistant general manager. Makes all kinds of sense. McLeod worked for the Padres. He actually has an area scout signed Paul McAnulty, who went up in their big leagues, which is kind of funny. Then he worked with Theo there, came with Theo to Boston. He's a San Diegan, however you want to call it. And so he's kind of going into he's getting a promotion, which is, makes sense, and now he'll probably have a hand in hiring a scouting director, which they still haven't done there in San Diego. And then Donovan Tate, their number 1 prospect, their first-round draft pick this year, 3rd overall, gets hurt in an ATV crash and has a broken jaw, according to the San Diego Union-Tribune. That's a whole lot of air going on with the Padres. They had a really fascinating year, I think, on the minor leagues.
They had a fascinating year everywhere.
Yeah,
I mean, like,
right.
I we were writing up the lead for the web today, and you're looking at this team. There are very few, besides, at the big league level, this has just been a complete turnover year for the Padres. They have a different owner.
Right.
They have an entirely different, almost an entirely different front office.
It will be, definitely.
By the time we're done. And really, even at the big league level, they still have the same cornerstone. Adrian Gonzalez is.
For now.
For now, at least, the franchise. But, Jake Peavy was the, he was the franchise.
He's the number 1 prospect of the decade for the Padres. Easily.
And then you look at the minor league level, this top 10, a lot of there's a couple of draftees in it, but there's also guys that they acquired during the season. There's a lot of turnover in San Diego.
And we really like their draft this year as well. And I think last year's draft was a good draft for San Diego. Really, this draft is basically 08 and 09 drafts and trades, and that's it. There's no holdovers from previously, and there is no team that drafted worse in the 2000s than the Padres. I just don't think it's anywhere close. No team that whiffed as often on first round picks. One of their best first round picks of the decade is Tim Stauffer, I love Tim Stauffer.
Who has to be considered a draft bust.
He has to be considered a draft bust, and he's had 2 years where he's been in the big leagues as an up and down kind of guy. He did pitch better in 2009. Mad props to Tim Stauffer for kind of pricking himself off the scrap heap. But, from Jake Gautreau to Matt Bush to Cesar Carrillo and all the other injured guys in between, it's just been one disaster after another. And the fact that Padres, you'll see it on the Fever chart. There's a pretty deep trough of how low the Padres farm system has ranked for years, and this will be the first year in a while there's going to be an upward trend in their farm system talent this year, because I think that a lot of their college guys they drafted in 08 did perform, and we liked their draft again in 2009. It's the Baseball America podcast. He's JJ. I'm John. We're talking
about,
we were talking a little bit about scouting right there, JJ, and Michael Kilbourn out of Seattle. I wonder if he's any relation to Craig. He emails, I was wondering, how do scouts hold themselves accountable? Scouting seems more like an art than like a science, but it stands to reason that there are good scouts as well as bad ones. I would be curious as to your responses. Regards, Michael in Seattle.
The thing that jumps out to me is that when you say how do scouts hold them, you know, they don't really hold themselves accountable, because if you're a scout, unless you're the most honest person in the world, you know, whether you've been scouting well or scouting poorly, you're going to sell yourself, you
right.
know, just to try to keep your job. But there's not been a whole lot. I mean, it's always been a complaint that there isn't as much evaluation of scouting as there maybe should be.
At least publicly.
But that being said, you can tell that teams have guys that they believe in maybe more than others. I mean,
that's true.
There are different, you know, and a lot of times because they've earned that right. You know, like you could look at these top tens. You'll see a lot of times the same names popping up over and over. Maybe that's because it just happened that they, you know, went back, you know, to that area where they had been scouting
right.
from before. But a lot of times that also comes down to, especially when you see, if you see a top 10 guy in there and it's like 15th round pick and you read the background and it says
right.
signed for $10,000, that's a scout who did a good job. And you'll often notice that guy gets more guys like that, because once a guy's proven that he can find hidden gems, then you kind of go back to him and let him.
That's it.
You earn the right to get some more chances.
You keep going back to that well, there's no doubt. You know, we're talking about the National League West, and I'll see if I can find it quickly. I doubt that I will. But there's one of the guys who always has jumped out to me in this regard was a guy, the Giants. If you go through the history of Lewis Clark State, the NAIA power that's won, what, 13 NAIA championships, in their history, they have, I think, 7 big leaguers, 8 big leaguers, and almost all of them are Giants, were the Giants, or were originally signed by the Giants. And it was the same scout, and I'm trying to find his name right now. He's no longer their scout because he's become ill. He had diabetes, and he lost a foot, I believe. He can no longer physically scout. I can't get his name. It's John Schaefer. That's who it was. It's John Schaefer.
And it's like he developed a trust that you knew
yeah.
that John Schaefer,
yeah.
you know.
I mean, Marvin Bernard, Steve Decker, who's now is still managing their farm system, Keith Folk, Steve Reed. This is a scout who made an impact on an organization. So there are some ways, there's some tangible ways you can tell. Tom Karanek is another guy, I believe, scouts the Texas area for the Giants. But what some clubs do, JJ, that I've started to find out is some clubs, you can see how much they trust the scout, but another organization, excuse me, will come after that scout and try to hire him as a cross-checker. Sometimes you'll see teams that basically have area guys who basically function as their own cross-checker, who they don't you don't have to cross-check that guy's area to draft that guy in the first 5 rounds. And you'll see I'm not going to name names,
right.
but I've come across that in doing draft coverage where I'll ask an area guy, do you know if this guy's getting cross-checked? And he'll say, well, there's these clubs that are really on him, even they aren't cross-checking him, because I can tell you this guy doesn't need to be cross-checked. And that's come up. And you'll see sometimes guys who have large regions on their own, sometimes those guys are basically glorified cross-checkers. They're area scouts in title, but they're basically their own cross-checkers.
Right, they've earned that.
There's some of those scouts around, and then there's other. Yeah, I think you have to say the Twins trust Howard Norsetter, because they've signed 20-some guys from Australia and Europe, where another organizations really do that.
Right, and you know also with that, with the international guys like that,
yeah.
We're not talking, by international, I'm talking Australia, Japan, things
yeah,
like that.
Not Latin America.
Not Latin America. Latin America, you have multiple guys get good
right.
looks at a guy.
Right.
If you're signing a guy out of Australia, a lot of times the international scout is,
right.
he's the guy who saw him.
That's right. And obviously I think the Twins trust him. They gave Max Kepler $775,000 or $800,000, an unprecedented sum for a European position player. Obviously, the Mariners rightfully have a lot of trust in Bob Engel and Ted Hyde. Bob Engel's their international scouting director. Ted Hyde's their Pacific Rim guy. Who's more active in the Pacific Rim than the Mariners? Nobody. So I mean,
the example I can think of
Choo's a great example of a Korean guy He's the only Korean position player in the big leagues, and other teams have whiffed on guys like whether it's Hee-Sop Choi, who had a decent career but was never as much as what he was supposed to be, or Sung-Yop Lee, who was the best player in Korea and has never really even made it really big in Japan, not to mention coming to the United States. But Shin-Soo Chu was their top amateur pitcher and hitter, and now that guy's a big-time major league player. So it's great scouting internationally by the Mariners.
Another example that I just think of, with the Reds, is Jeff Brookins.
He
drafted Chris Heisey in the 17th
right.
round. You see, I noticed that, year after year, you'll see a guy 10th round on, that he always gets a guy.
That's right.
And it's like, well, he's shown that, he can find gems out there.
The Rays, every year, take a guy the 4th, 5th, 6th round out of the Pacific Northwest. I'm blanking on the scout's name right now. Paul Kirsch. I'm pretty sure it's Paul Kirsch. They clearly like Paul Kirsch, I'm sure they cross-check him, but every year, and it's been guys like Ryan Royster, Tyler Morrison is in their farm system right now. It's been some guys who've made some impact on their career, on their farm system. Royster had that year we had 30 home runs in the Saturday League, so they've taken some guys out
but
there.
But basically, that explains part of it, which is that there are scouts who teams know, okay, hey, this guy's had a lot of success. At the same time, I think it's fair to say that in scouting, it's as much who you know, scouting is something. There are very few. You've run into very few scouts I've been scouting for this team for 25 years.
That's right.
I mean, scouting is a nomadic profession. Both, both in
literally,
the fact that literally, that you actually just travel all the time, but also from the standpoint that you usually, you're with the club, and then their scouting director is, moves on or gets fired or whatever.
There's
and then
a guy
you...
around here I know since being here 13 years, one of the first area scouts I got to meet around here. He's been with 5 organizations in my 13 years here. I mean, every time I see him, I feel like I see him sporting someone else's gear. It's pretty funny, actually. And it's unexpected. All the changes are usually unexpected. So, and that's one of the things that the Blue Jays have actually addressed, JJ, they're trying to address with this, and this should be a column of mine coming out of Indianapolis, I hope. The Blue Jays are doubling, maybe some people have read about it, they're basically doubling their scouting department, and they're giving them smaller areas, they're giving their guys more time off, and they basically want to make it a better experience to scout for the Blue Jays, and they're hoping that's an edge they can gain.
That would be an edge because it is a, it's a brutal life.
There's no doubt. And that's one of the things that they said. That's one of the things that the Blue Jays say is they want it to be better to scout for Toronto than to scout for other clubs. And I've always thought it just makes sense to have more scouts than other teams if you can, and to have more minor league instruction. And I really praise Toronto for that, and Tampa, which is going to 2 field coordinators, 2 roving hitting guys,
wow.
2 pitching coordinators. It just
That's
makes just, sense.
It's just, it's, and the thing about it is the amount of money that we're talking about is the amount of money that you, I mean, I'm joking a little bit, but that you blow on, adding, shrimp to the post-game
right.
spread at the big league
That's
level.
Right.
I mean, it's what we're talking about. Adding a second rover at the minor league level, even when you throw in the travel, if you could produce one more big leaguer because of that, you've more than paid for.
It's paid for the next 10 years.
Right.
Basically, I mean, it's
right,
it's
because that first 3-4 years of that big leaguer, if you manage to fix somebody who had talent but, was not headed in the right direction, that 4 years, you're going to save well more than that salary.
No doubt. It's a Baseball America podcast. He's JJ. I'm John. I'm just going back to an earlier point where we were talking about the Padres, JJ. I wanted to segue a little bit into the winter meetings, what can be expected besides the Rule 5 draft. Our Rule 5 draft early preview is up. We'll have another one from Indy next week. But going back to the Padres, Adrian Gonzalez is probably the biggest name out there, along with Roy Halladay. That's a potential trade to happen. Do you see either of those guys getting traded in the winter meetings? Do you think that's going to happen?
I think Halladay has done a good job of kind of forcing the Blue Jays' hand in that and he has the right to. I mean, this is why players have, clauses in their contracts and all. But
right.
If when he says, hey, you either trade me by the start of spring training or I'm here until the end.
I went through this mess last year. I'm not going through that again.
Right. If that's the case, well, then if you're the Blue Jays, you pretty much need to trade him.
Yeah.
You're not looking like, you can't say, hey, that Toronto team right now looks like this is, that they're definitely going to challenge for, they're going to challenge the Yankees and the Red Sox and the
right.
Orioles and the Rays.
Right. And both improving franchises.
Right.
I would love, I don't know how realistic this is, I would love to see Roy Halladay go to Colorado. I just think it'd be awesome for him to be traded. The Rockies have the farm system to make the trade. They have quantity. They have pitching talent. I think that, you know, I think they have some athletes, although that's really, if I'm Toronto, what I'm looking for. Toronto's a bottom five farm system, JJ. I don't think there's a question that when you don't know who your number one is, that's a sign that you, and it's because you don't have a real number one prospect as opposed to you have three.
Right. Not knowing who your number one is because, you know, it's like, well, you could take this number, you know, this number one, or you could take this guy number one. And they both feel like it. That's
right.
One thing. Not having a number one, just like, well, that guy's really a number four.
They've actually done better at developing talent than I think we've given them credit for in some ways. And at the same time, they still haven't ever really come close, in my mind, to putting things together under J.P. Ricciardi. And so I'm fascinated. I think they should trade Halliday this offseason. I don't see why you'd hold on to him. They should have traded him last summer, you know, if you're trying to maximize his value. But I think you have to avoid getting a Cliff Lee deal where I think Cleveland did not get as much as they should have gotten.
And you've got to avoid, I mean, Cliff Lee's one, and you got to throw Johan Santana.
You're right.
Because to me, the parallels are pretty
based
striking.
Johan Santana for J.J. Hardy at this point.
You know, and Johan Santana forced the hand, you know. I mean, everyone knew they had to trade him, and so they sat there. The other thing I will say with that, though, is that I do think for baseball, I kind of hope that he doesn't end up a Red Sox or a Yankee
because
I think that'll add to the perception that, oh, you know, they just get whoever.
Competitiveness.
Right, they'll just get whoever they want.
Absolutely. Adrian Gonzalez, I think, it seems like there's so much change already in San Diego that maybe you'd want to not do that, but at the same time, they do have Kyle Blanks.
They have Kyle Blanks, who is a first baseman.
He's a first baseman, not a left fielder. He's pretty good. I mean, he hit last year.
And you would think that Adrian Gonzalez, even though you don't get as much value for first baseman, but Adrian Gonzalez is good enough.
He's a special first baseman.
Right. He's not just a good one. He's a great one.
Yeah, he's a guy who you hit in the 3-4 spot in a playoff lineup, and you have to pitch to. He makes way too much sense for Boston because you could slide Euclid to third base. And that's the thing that Boston clearly missed from the Ortiz-Manny years. They did not have the guy in the middle of the lineup that you really feared. They had guys you could be pitched to. Nothing against Jason Bay, but he's not Manny Ramirez. Nothing against Euclid. He's not Big Poppy circa 2007. Nothing against Big Poppy, but his time has passed. So, I mean, he had a nice second half. He's still not the guy who you can't pitch to. You know, he couldn't be pitched to and who hit quality pitching. Boston clearly lacked that in 2009.
I do think... If you're the Padres, you're in a much better situation than what we talked about with Halliday, in that what you do is you go into the winter meetings, and if someone wows you,
right,
you really just ask the question, does this make our team better long term? Adrian Gonzalez is so good, okay, but does this trade make us better? And if it does, then you do it.
To me, you can't make that trade unless you get premium up the middle pieces in exchange. I mean, this is a team that had a guy go from low class A to being their everyday shortstop and being their best option in the middle of the diamond in Everett Cabrera. That's good for Everett Cabrera, great pro scouting by the Padres, and an indictment of their inability under the Grady Fuson and Chief Gayton regimes of scouting and player development to bring in middle-of-the-diamond talents. So you need athletes in the middle of the diamond. You probably need some catching. You probably need a center fielder. You need impact, and you have to have impact in the middle of the diamond. They were pretty good at drafting thumbing lefties and corner bats, you know, but that's what's easy to scout with numbers and with your same old approaches. They need athletes, and they haven't shown an ability to do that, and it was shocking that they did that in 2009.
And I'm going to segue now. You mentioned Cabrera. Cabrera was the best guy out of last year's, Rule 5 draft. There's no real doubt about that.
Yep.
Him and Donald Veal were the only two guys that you could say, you know.
Stuck with their clubs. Darren O'Day had the second best season, but he didn't stick with the Mets.
Right, but the two guys.
It's the Mets' fault.
Which, and the point can always be made, you know, the Rule 5 draft is always something that is, there's more
hat
to
than
it.
Cattle.
Yeah, I mean, there's more to it on that day than there is long term. That being said, there are Cabrera, obviously Josh Hamilton, Johan Santana. You can always throw out guys, hey, this guy was, you know. I mean, Johan Santana by himself.
Right.
It's like you have to pay attention to it.
Absolutely. Joaquin Soria. I mean, that's a pretty good one right there. This year's Rule 5 class, obviously the Rule 5 the last couple of years is not as exciting. They really deepened the pool of players.
Right.
They made a much shallower pool of players.
Because
they
what they did
the
is they added a year.
Right.
before players become eligible. Well,
your 2006 draft would have been in play under the old rules for college guys. So I assume the Pirates would have protected Brad Lincoln. They probably would have, but they would have had to make that choice. Or who were some other 06 draftees? There was somebody else that I was looking at the other day, Brett Sinkfield for the Marlins, who's kind of been a disappointment. They would have had to make that decision.
Right. The decisions become a lot easier when you add one more year before you make those decisions.
Right. So now it's 2005 college guys, right? I'm confusing myself in my head. Bottom line is we have the eligibility list. We have the official list. Can't say where. But we have the official list of eligibles. We went through the whole thing, talked to some scouts about it, ran through our own scouting reports, put up 10 numbers. I'm skeptical of even some of the guys I even listed.
Oh, the thing about this is that the point I want to make with the Rule 5 is we got 20 names up there.
Yeah.
We'll probably have another 10 to 15,
yeah,
you know, by the time we get done talking to people at the rule, you know, at the winter meetings and all. That being said, I'll make the prediction right now. It's a 50-50 shot whether the best guy who comes out of the Rule 5 draft this year is even on that list. And the reason I say
right.
that is because the guys who people talk about are the ones who are the obvious ones.
Yep. No, you're right.
Donald Veal was an obvious guy last
year.
The
guy who should have been popped was the guy that I was all over last year, Pedro Figueroa. I'm sorry,
right.
but I was right about that. The guy had a great year this year.
Right.
Very excited about that.
But Everest Cabrera was not a guy who was getting buzz, you know, really that much because
I don't even remember.
Right. I mean, but he was because, you know, a lot of times these guys are, you know.
Terrell Young had all the buzz last year.
Terrell Young, you know, which, you know.
Yeah.
You could say at the time, it was like, yeah, no, that guy's not going to stick. You know, but you know, like, if you said who's the guy, to me, of this group, you know, we did our, you know, initial, you
yeah,
know, early preview. If you say who's the guy who jumps out just from the standpoint of having talent, now, that doesn't mean he's going to be able to stick, but if you said, hey, the talent, I think it's Archimedes Caminero.
I agree with you. I think Archimedes Caminero is the most interesting guy, and I drew the parallel to Jorge Sosa, who was a guy who jumped from short season ball to the big leagues and stuck and had a career of some note, although really he had the one great year with the Braves.
But he had a great year.
He had a great year. He won 13 games. I think he was a little lucky. He walked a lot of guys. But the bottom line is he was an arm strength guy with limited experience, and that's Archimedes Caminero. Archimedes Caminero also has much more pitching experience than Sosa, who was a conversion guy. He's 22 years old and hasn't been above short season ball except for, like, what, 10 appearances?
Right.
So.
Now, and that's the thing. I ran his name by a scout who told me, he said, the problem you have with a guy like that is if he was a lefty, he's a slam dunk.
Yeah.
And the reason being that you can carry
yeah.
a Rule 5 lefty in the pen so much easier than you can a righty because as a lefty, especially if he throws hard, you just say, okay, well, we're going to put you out there occasionally
right.
as our number two or number three lefty to get a guy out.
I know the comparison doesn't hold a lot of water because of the physical part, but you know who Caminero actually reminds me of as a Rule 5 guy is Derek Turnbow. Derek Turnbow was in low A. He was in our top 10 for the Phillies, actually, the year he was in low A. He got Rule 5 because he was so far away, but he was an arm strength guy with a power breaking ball, and he stuck because I think in the right situation, you bring that guy, a guy like Caminero, he's your long guy, he's your 11th or 12th guy, he just eats up some innings, there's going to be games where he's going to get lit up, and you have to wear it. I don't think a contending team can do it.
No, no.
But I think he's worth the risk.
There are 10 teams right now who
yeah.
know that they will not be contending.
And Turnbow proved out to be worth the risk. I believe he had an all-star season as a closer, which it's a little fluky. But I like both the Garcias from the Phillies. I do the Phillies organization reports. I mean, not organization, the top 30. I've gotten a lot of positive reports on Henry Garcia. The first time I did my ranking, I still haven't written up Henry Garcia, but he was going to be in the back of the 30. I might drop him out of the 30 now. I'm going to go ahead and write him up, but for whatever organization Rule 5 is in. But I think he will get Rule 5. He is a lot like Everett Cabrera from last year's draft. He does not have the ability to play shortstop like Everett Cabrera because he doesn't have the arm strength. He does have the range to play short. I think his arm is probably like a 50 arm, which is really below average for shortstop.
Everyone always throw up, you know, David Eckstein can do it.
Right. I don't think he can do it. I do think he could be a super utility guy. I think he's a lesser Sean Figgins, to be honest with you. I don't think he gives you he doesn't have Figgins' arm strength, but I think he could be a second baseman. He's an energy guy. He runs, and he does have some enough strength that he's not a Judy. He's not going to hit for power, but I don't think he's going to get overpowered. And he's older. He's 23 years old. The other guys that I kind of like in here are some of the left-handers. I don't think yet. Okay, yeah, Edgar Osuna and Ben Jukic. I'm a Ben Jukic fan. He's older. His fastball has not come along, but he does spin a breaking ball, and he's got size. If he can create angle on the fastball, I do think he's a guy who in shorter stints could be a useful lefty out of a bullpen.
Yeah, I do think
he's had some success in winter ball as well.
Right. I think that I do the Reds list. I don't think that he's someone who, I guess, my philosophy for Rule 5 or why guys get picked is that you look at long-term him having,
right.
You know, there's two ways you take a guy. One, you take a guy, I mean, the Yankees a couple of years ago, I'm just blanking on the first baseman, Josh Phelps.
Oh, yeah.
When they take Josh Phelps and it's like, hey, we can get this guy cheap this
yeah.
way, and he might play in the, you know, he might be our backup first baseman.
Right.
Well, there's that approach, and then there's the, this guy's potential is so good that it's worth us carrying him on the roster.
I agree. It's not I don't know if, a
I don't,
guy.
I don't know if, I don't think Jukic fits either of those. I don't think you say, well, clearly he can help our team right now to
right.
a point where it's worth it, and I don't
think
he has enough upside to.
Yeah, I think that he can if you believe in the breaking ball. And I've had reports of the breaking ball being plus at times, so that's why, that to me is the issue, is that he is a lefty who spins a breaking ball. And I think because of the size, he might have enough angle where the fastball might play up, even though it's fringy. But that's, like I said, that's what teams are looking for.
Right,
they're looking. That's one of the profiles they look for, is the situational lefty, and Wesley Wright is a guy who fit that for the Astros, made it a couple years ago, now is being converted into a possible starting option in winter ball. So that's the future upside for Ben Jukic. At best, he's a John Holama type.
Right. I mean that's the difference I was going to say is just that
his right
has a little more velo to him.
Right, but his breaking ball might give Jukic a chance to help you now.
The interesting thing is that Jukic, at least in the minors, has always been better. He's never, as
right.
a reliever, been as, seems like he's never been as comfortable relieving as he has starting.
I saw that in his numbers the other day when I put him up here. And that's why Edgar Osuna might be that same kind of guy, a below-average fastball. It's interesting. The Braves, I think, don't have a great farm system right now. It's very top heavy, not a lot of depth, and they might get hit hard. I think the Phillies might get hit a little bit. The Yankees might take a little depth issue because they do have some.
Hey, the Yankees had a ton of guys taken last year. None of them
stuck,
but
right.
they
did. Ivanova, they're very lucky, didn't stick. Ivanova came back and had a nice year. Will be in their top 30. So that's one of the more interesting things about the Rule 5 is seeing which organizations get hit the hardest. But we'll see. I wouldn't say the Rule 5 is much ado about nothing, but it's much ado about not much.
Right. It's something. It's a fascinating day.
Exercise.
It's a fascinating day in December for baseball. I mean,
That's true.
We get to talk about prospects in December.
That's the best part about it. You're not talking about arbitration. You're not talking about a salary dump. You're not talking about non-tender.
I mean,
don't have to do with money.
The other stories that we'll see out of the winter meetings are going to be not nearly as fun.
Not mostly. I mean,
there may be a trade or two, which will be fun, but we're
right.
going to be talking about, the upcoming CBA. We're going to be talking about revenue sharing and how much
Scott
from the
Boris.
Central fund is, going to different teams.
We'll talk about Scott Boras holding court. I look forward to talking to Scott in Indianapolis about one of his clients that he advises, James Paxton, a left-hander at Kentucky, who is suing the University of Kentucky in a really disgusting display of NCAA rules and a college, I think, trying to CIA, cover its rear by coming down on a kid. And any time that you have someone, if you're a parent, any time you come across a situation where the school or some other institution says, hey, do this and don't tell your parents, they don't have your best interest at heart.
No.
And that's what the University of Kentucky did. They told James Paxton, take this survey, submit to this NCAA survey and investigation, and don't tell your parents and don't tell your lawyer. They must not have known that his lawyer was Scott Boras. That is the wrong, as Ice Cube said, that's the wrong one to mess with. I'm editing that for content, but you don't mess with the Zohan. In this case, the Zohan is Scott Boras. So.
Wow, that was like four different analogies.
Bad cultural references
yeah.
all in a row. I don't like the NCAA or Kentucky's chances in that one, JJ. Do you? He's also hired the same attorney who represented Andy Oliver.
Well, to me the big thing is the NCAA keeps fighting this battle, and this just seems like a battle that's not only designed for them to lose, but meant for them to lose. Because really what it comes down to is you're trying to figure out a way to take away rights and you can say, hey, you don't have to play college, but and it's true, you don't have to play college
right.
sports, but I just don't see what the upside is that when you talk about, well, no, you can have an agent for this sport, but you're not playing, If you play pro football, pro baseball, but you're still a college football player, you can have an agent for baseball then, but that's okay. Having an agent for the sport that you're playing, which you need to make decisions that involve hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, is wrong. And you can have an advisor, though, when they can't negotiate for you, but they can put the words in your mouth. It just all, it's one of those things where you look at it and it's like, it's the attempt to make an appearance of something, not make any substantial change.
Talk about anachronistic. It's just like, it's Avery Brundage. It's like NCAA as this bastion of amateurism. And I think, especially at the University of Kentucky, we know it's not. See Chris Mills and
Eric Manuel.
Eric Manuel, that's right.
From Macon, Georgia. I know that story well.
I think anybody who thinks that Kentucky's basketball program is amateur, I'd like them to talk to the guys at UMass and Memphis about John Calipari's past. It is ironic, to say the least, that it's Kentucky that's saying we got to have this squeaky clean baseball program. So I could go on. I will not. We will see you from Indianapolis. We probably will podcast from there next week. I will force our two quietest staff members, not named Jim Schoenard, Matt Eddy, and Josh Leventhal, to podcast with me. Or you might just get me and Jim Callis as Jim edits the handbook from his hotel room in Indianapolis. So for J.J. Cooper, I'm John Manuel. Send those questions into us at podcast@baseballamerica.com, and we'll see you next time. So long, everybody.